Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. National U.S. exercise guidelines recommend that children run, jump, and play for at least an hour a day. But just one in five American children get the exercise they need. Researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital studied the effects of a morning exercise program that could help. Joining us by phone is lead author of the study, Children's Pediatric Endocrinology Fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Rachel Wooten. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Why is an hour a day deemed enough?
So that's from looking at large samples of studies, and it's actually a subject of some debate between some of the medical associations out there exactly how much we need. But basically, the 60 minutes a day is really what we're looking for to have some of the health benefits of physical activity, looking at weight outcomes and also prevention of future diseases.
Tell us about why it's important for children to get that hour a day. What are those diseases and
yeah,
outcomes?
Absolutely. So the diseases that we worry about, so it's a lot of times it's hard kind of seeing these things because many of the diseases that are associated with having higher weight do occur later in life, dealing with hypertension, so high blood pressure, risk of diabetes. There are even some studies showing that things like pregnancy can be harder if people are overweight later in life, if women are, heart disease, a whole wide variety of different just poor health outcomes, all happening much later in life. So kids aren't experiencing these things for the most part, but kind of getting kids on a healthier path earlier in life is really the goal here.
And people who later in life have these kind of problems, it tends, the weight issue and the lack of exercise is something that happens young. It tends to happen more often with kids who weren't active as youngsters.
Right. So okay. One thing that we see in the research is that when you look at kids who have healthy habits when they're in their younger ages, those habits do happen to track further in life. We know that as kids get older, it's just a matter of fact that physical activity levels do decline, most often during the teenage years, just because there are so many other competing pressures that happen at that time. So it's really important to kind of at least get kids off on a healthy foot with having some appreciation for being active in the younger ages that they can kind of work on carrying with them throughout life. One thing we know, too, is that weight isn't kind of the end-all be-all, and that if you are active, it actually does help just put things, kind of I like to think of it a bit in a, kind of like a more fine-tuned machine from the way that your body just kind of functions in terms of processing nutrients, sugar, all of that, if you do also have exercise on board as one of your habits.
What has changed over time? Kids used to get an hour a day without even trying, right?
Yep, absolutely. I think that that's something that a lot of kind of parents and people who don't have a young, or I should say parents of older kids in college now, even people who haven't kind of seen the landscape recently, think that, oh, that's just what kids do. They're running around. But there's a lot now that's just made it a lot harder. A lot of times there's a lot of concern with safety being outside, roads and having safe parks and places to play. So parents a lot of times feel they don't have a safe place for their kids to be active outside. There's also a lot of just kind of more emphasis on parents being present when kids aren't playing. So it's not kind of the stories that a lot of people think about from their youth where they were kind of out running around in the forest for hours at a time. And another thing, too, is there have been a lot more pressures on schools in terms of working on academics. And that has cut back a lot on the physical activity time that happens in school. Around only one out of every two kids, so 50% of kids have at least physical activity once a week as physical education in schools.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about the importance of that hour a day of exercise for kids. My guest is Dr. Rachel Wooten. She's a child pediatric endocrinology fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also the lead author of a recent study that looked at a new before school exercise program. We're going to talk about that. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. So you just said that kids are getting less exercise in school than ever before. They're tightening up recess. They're limiting what kinds of activities you can do during recess. Tell us about the study. For starters, why before school?
So before school is a great time because it's a time when kids really don't have anything else that's scheduled. When we think about adding physical activity opportunities after school, that's a time when you could potentially be taking away from kids who are participating in sports activities or other extracurricular activities. Also, if you're talking about adding something within the school day, then you are facing the fact that you might be taking time away from academics. But this before school period there, most schools aren't starting in terms of elementary school in our area until around 8:30, and then middle school is around 7:30. So you have a time, too, where a lot of times parents are trying to get out the door early to go to work, and there's about probably a half hour, an hour of time where kids aren't really active doing much else. So it's kind of taking advantage of a time period where kids otherwise might be sitting looking at a screen, watching TV, and using it to be active. The other thing that's great about the before school time period is that there is a lot of research showing that being physically active actually improves your attention, your cognition in the time that's following. So when you have a kid that's going to be sitting through a pretty long day, kind of priming the brain to be able to pay attention during school is a great thing.
Right. I mean, we know that research, and yet schools keep cutting back on physical activity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, it's something where one of my interests in doing the research is there is a lot of importance placed on academic achievement, and I think that that is extremely important. But instead of looking at it as a either-or, mm-hmm. we're either going to prioritize being active or academics, is can we use it really together that by kids being active, we can also help them do better academically.
Tell us what they did during that hour a day before school starts.
Yeah, absolutely. So the one thing that's great about the Box program is it does have some flexibility in terms of kind of school to school and lesson to lesson, but also does follow a basic structure because it's really important to have something that is reproducible when we're thinking about it from a research standpoint. Mm-hmm. Also, at least thinking back to my childhood, a lot of the physical activity was a little bit more competitive, so you would have to shoot baskets, or it was very skill-focused and more kind of individual-based, but this mm-hmm. is really just focused on kids having fun and being active while they're being fun. So the sessions start out with a fun warm-up game, and then it's a running activity. So in some of the sessions that I observe for the running activity, there's a song that's playing, and when the song goes off, the kids all run to their separate corner. There's a skill of the week. So the skill of the week when I was observing a session recently was just learning to kind of just how to do a basic push-up, which kids do get a sense of satisfaction in terms of learning a skill. And then a cool-down game to end the session. And then finally, just small nutrition tip to end the session also. And in one of the studies that I observed, it was just really heartwarming. And why I love working with this age group is just that kids really do take things to heart when they learn them and are excited to share them. So one of the kids, and this was not a study, it was not a session part of the research study, but one of the kids had participated in the program before. And so he learned the fact before, and he was just so happy to share the fact that he'd learned. And it was actually a fact about water and how water, why water is important. So he was just so excited to share this fact that he had learned before about nutrition. It was just kind of great seeing how kids really do take to heart what they learn and are excited to share it.
Does the time of day play a role? Because I know back when I could work out in the morning, I felt like it got more success. It might have been because I was younger. There might have been a lot of other factors, but does time of day play a role?
I think in terms of what we're thinking about, whether or not it's going to play a role in terms of whether kids are getting more out of the activity,
uh-huh.
There's not a ton of research that supports that right now.
Uh-huh.
Definitely not in the pediatric population. I know that there's some conflicting evidence for the adult population. I think the important thing when we're thinking about kids being active is that anything is better than nothing. So just finding times when it works is the most important thing.
How did the school manage this? I mean, could anybody do this?
Yeah, and that was one thing that is a challenge of kind of doing this kind of research is
right.
that the schools really opened it up to anyone who wanted to participate, and they enrolled all the kids on their own, and then the research group came in and we worked with them. We didn't want to limit saying that any kids couldn't participate, which is one of the limitations in the study, which is all the kids that are participating because they wanted to participate.
So there's no control group.
So there's no control group. Yeah. So when you think about doing research, you ideally want to have kids who taking all the kids in the school and randomly assigning you can participate, you're not going to participate. So everyone kind of, you think about the kids being exchangeable. Mm-hmm. But just really the goal of the program was having it accessible to everyone. So we weren't able to kind of look at it from a research standpoint. But on the flip side of that, all the kids in the school available K through five are these schools mm-hmm. were able to participate.
Is this something that schools can really afford to be investing in?
So another nice thing about at least this intervention, why we're interested in looking at it, is it's something that doesn't take a lot of resources up front. It's good if you have some balls and pennies and things like that that are kind of standard gym equipment, but mm-hmm. nothing fancy beyond that. And a lot of the training is just an online system where volunteers in the school can go on and look at the training. So it's not something that is extremely intensive, and it's really meant to empower people to help kids be active kind of wherever they are and realize that it isn't something you have to have like a fancy athletic gym to have. It's not something you have to have the right shoes to have. It's something that really any kid can do at any time. So just making it more accessible also is one of the goals of kind of a program like this.
What were some of the challenges of the study? Just the lack of a control group or what else?
Yeah, I mean, the lack of a control group. And then whenever you're dealing with working in schools, you're going to have some kids that aren't there at the time when you're coming in to do the follow-up assessments. Mm-hmm. You might not always have that perfect 100% of kids at the beginning and 100% of kids at the end. Another thing that's challenging, too, is when you are looking at kids across a wide variety of age ranges. And sorry, I misspoke earlier. We actually were looking at grades K through 8. Okay. I have a current study looking at K through 5.
All right.
You're also dealing with kids that are at very different stages of their development and also what their bodies are supposed to be doing in terms of growing. So in looking at our measure, we, as our main outcome, looked at changes in kids' BMI and tried to standardize that by looking at kids' BMI in relation to other kids their age. But if you take any fifth grade class, for example, you're going to have kids that are on the earlier stages of developing versus mm-hmm. the later stages of developing. So BMI can be a tricky thing to interpret in that setting. So BMI is something where a lot of studies aren't able to find things just because of the fact that there's so much variation from child to child, depending on where they are developmentally at that time.
Were these programs already in place before you decided to do the study or what? And are they going to continue?
So these schools, as far as I know, are continuing. And I know that even from the time when we started working with them, more schools have begun doing the program. Mm-hmm. But this is a new program at the schools where we had done the study.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Rachel Wooten, for talking with us today. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Rachel Wooten is a children's pediatric endocrinology fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital. They did a recent study that looked at a new before-school exercise program. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Poverty, violence, divorce, substance abuse, all of those circumstances can traumatize a child in ways that follow her through childhood and beyond. Ohio is among the top five states for children experiencing trauma, according to a study conducted by Child Trends, a nonpartisan research organization. Joining us by phone is co-author of the study, Vanessa Sachs. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I mentioned those categories that are familiar, poverty, violence, divorce, substance abuse. How do they all fit together in that same adverse childhood experience?
Yeah, so adverse childhood experiences are potentially traumatic events and experiences that can occur in a child's life. As you mentioned, some of the most common ones that we looked at in our report specifically that just came out are economic hardship. So a child having lived in a family that had a hard time covering the basics like food and housing and parental divorce or separation. We looked at 8 experiences overall. So in addition to economic hardship and parental separation were parental incarceration, living with someone who abuses alcohol or drugs, witnessing violence in the home, living with someone with mental illness, witnessing or being victim of violence in the neighborhood, and the death of a parent or guardian. So there's no single agreed upon list of ACEs. The original study that was done in the 1990s that coined that term, adverse childhood experiences, and most lists or definitions that have been developed since then include experiences like abuse and neglect as well. And those just weren't asked about in the data that we use for our report.
Do they, adverse childhood experiences, what difference does it mean to have multiple? Because I would imagine they often operate in multiples.
Yeah, they do often go hand in hand. So to sort of give you a broad understanding of why we are concerned about adverse childhood experiences, that original study in the 1990s that I mentioned linked them with almost every major public health issue that we face in the U.S., whether it's obesity or substance use or depression or suicide, smoking, chronic disease, and those are all negative outcomes that we see in adulthood. While children are still in childhood or in adolescence, we see that children who have experienced ACEs have trouble with self-control, with managing their emotions, with paying attention, with social relationships. Those are all life skills that are critical for later success in school, in the workplace, in interpersonal relationships. So these are really important experiences to recognize and address.
What are the effects of stress? I mean, a child, say, isn't involved in a divorce. They're part of it, though. I guess they're involved as a child. I'm trying to think of what, you know, they may not be personally, physically abused. What's happening? What is the stress doing to them?
Yeah. And it's important to note that we're not talking about regular levels of stress here. So repeated or frequent exposure to these stressful and traumatic events can put a child's brain into a kind of constant or near constant fight or flight mode. And that can change the way their brain develops. It can affect the way they develop attention and memory and the regulation of their stress response. So some stress is important for us to experience just in order to develop a healthy stress response system in our bodies. Things like the stress a child might feel around taking a test in school is likely to produce a sort of a short-lived physiological response in their body. So if you think about like elevated heart rate and blood pressure, producing stress hormones like cortisol, and then your body kind of goes back to normal functioning. And even having an adverse event occur in your life, like the death of a parent, for example, or as you mentioned, divorce or separation of a parent, that doesn't necessarily have to trigger a toxic level of stress. We're still learning about why some people who have these adverse childhood experiences go on to have problems later on in life, while others are able to cope and recover. One of the things we know can buffer the effects of these experiences is a close and supportive relationship with a caring adult. But when ACEs are a problem is when they trigger these so-called toxic levels of stress, where the body's stress response system is basically just always on.
There's a multi-generational impact. I mean, is that referring to that it doesn't end with childhood or that you carry it on into adulthood?
Yeah, that is definitely one aspect of the research that's particularly sobering, is that there is some evidence that these effects can be passed on from generation to generation. And there's kind of two ways that could, we think that could happen. There's emerging research looking at what happens when a woman is pregnant and experiences extreme levels of stress. We think that can affect the fetus, possibly even changing the fetus's genetic programming. The other way that ACEs potentially affect multiple generations is that some of these experiences are both an adverse childhood experience themselves, as well as a possible negative outcome of ACEs. So, for example, living with an adult who's abusing alcohol or drugs is an adverse experience, but substance use is also a potential outcome from having experienced ACEs. So you can see how it might be a cyclical process, you know, that sort of affects the family for generations. And that's why it's so important when we're screening children for adverse experiences and other kinds of trauma to treat the whole family, not just the children. You know, if you think about that list of experiences that I mentioned, you can see that so many of them are really about things that are going on with the adults in the household.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a new study that, among other things, found that Ohio is one of the five states with the highest share of children who face the most adverse childhood experiences. My guest is Vanessa Sachs. She's a research scientist at Child Trends. That's a nonpartisan research organization. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So Ohio was among the states with the highest rates of kids that had adverse childhood experiences. What do we make of that? The rankings, what were the top four, or where in the rankings did Ohio fall, and why do you think that is?
Well, Ohio looks like the U.S. generally in terms of the number of children who've had at least one of these experiences. So 45% of children nationally have had at least one, and then 49% of children in Ohio have had at least one. So it's somewhat more children in Ohio than the U.S. as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But where Ohio falls higher in the rankings is when you break that down and look at kids who have had more than one experience. So Ohio stands out as one of the five states where the percent of children with at least three adverse childhood experiences is the highest. So nationally, 10% of children have had at least three adverse childhood experiences, where in Ohio it's 15%. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly concerning because the research points to the accumulation of these experiences as greatly increasing children's risk of later negative outcomes. When we look at specific experiences, Ohio is like the rest of the U.S. in that economic hardship and divorce or separation of a parent are the most common experiences. However, significantly more children in Ohio have experienced economic hardship at some point in their lives than children nationally. So in Ohio, it's almost a third of children have experienced their family having a hard time being able to afford basics like food or housing, compared to about a quarter of children nationally.
I was wondering, what are the other states that are up there with Ohio?
Yeah, so the other states that also have a significantly higher percent of children who have had at least three of these experiences are Arizona, Arkansas, Montana, and New Mexico. Other states that have particularly high rates of economic hardship among children are Arkansas again, Maine, Oklahoma, and West Virginia.
Those are very diverse groups of states. Is there anything connecting all of them besides these statistics?
Yeah. So we didn't look, at least in our report, specifically at what states with these high rates of experiences have in common. But one possible commonality is child poverty. One estimate is that I think in Ohio it's about 21% of children lived in poverty in 2016. The national average is just below that at around 19%, and that puts Ohio in about the top half of states in terms of poverty. And a lot of these adverse childhood experiences go hand in hand. So, for example, poverty and exposure to neighborhood violence can often be linked. That said, ACEs are definitely not something that are only experienced by low-income children, and that original ACEs study was actually conducted with a mostly white middle-class adult population.
Rochelle in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Rochelle.
Yes, I was asking my question, and I heard part of it being answered about poverty. Of course, we know the deleterious effects of poverty, but In terms of comparing our state, which is at the bottom, to states that are at the top, I'm going to guess that Massachusetts probably does very well. They pay their teachers very well, for example. What would be some of the policy implications insofar of what you've learned from the research?
Yeah, thanks, Rochelle. Yeah, the Massachusetts is one of the states with the smallest number of children who have had one of these experiences, along with Maryland and Minnesota. So states are approaching dealing with ACEs in a lot of different ways, states as well as cities or localities. And as of September of last year, there had been more than 40 bills passed or pending in 20 states that specifically mention ACEs. None of those were in Ohio, to my knowledge. So the kinds of things that states are passing legislation to do are appropriating funds for ACEs prevention, establishing task forces or study committees to better understand what are the specific issues in the state, requiring or encouraging healthcare providers to use an ACEs screening tool with their patients, requiring training on adverse childhood experiences for adults who work with youth, like school resource officers. So really, I think for in terms of the policy implications, it's important to look at what are the most prevalent experiences in your state to figure out what is going to be the best approach to preventing that experience from happening.
You know, the Arizona, Arkansas, Montana, New Mexico, some of the poorest states in the country, right?
Yes.
And Ohio doesn't feel like it belongs in that rank, but indeed it is.
It's certainly, Ohio is definitely not in that, you know, the top handful of states in terms of child poverty. It's somewhere probably in the top half of the states of the U.S.
Rochelle, thanks a lot for that call. Let's talk about the public health issue of this. You and others who study this say that it's a major public health issue. Why public health?
Well, it's, as you know, it's linked with so many of the public health issues that we face that are really pretty intractable. They're hard to figure out how to tackle. So, you know, I mentioned obesity and substance use, mental illness, chronic health problems. If we can figure out how to head those off when people are still in their childhood, mm-hmm. You know, that would be a major public health achievement.
How are communities and schools responding to this issue? You mentioned 40 bills, but what, you know, funding, study, healthcare screening, what about where kids are most?
Yeah. I, you know, really anyone who works with children can be trained to recognize the signs of trauma and to intervene in order to get the child and the family the help that they need. You know, the best possible scenario would, of course, be to prevent children from having these kinds of experiences in the first place. Mm-hmm. But we also need to focus on screening children and families for these experiences and other kinds of trauma so we can remove any kind of immediate threat and then refer children and families to the services interventions that make the most sense for their particular adverse experience that they're facing.
Except for feeding kids properly and making sure they're getting their nutrition and that kind of a thing, and maybe not feeling the effects of poverty, how do you not compound the problem? Say, you know, and this has been talked about a lot when it comes to fostering children, the whole foster situation, that sometimes taking the kids away from the parents is more traumatic than leaving them there and trying to work with them.
Yeah. You mentioned nutrition. I mean, that's definitely, you know, one of the sort of self-care skills that are really important for just helping. The idea is basically to help children develop a healthy stress response. So that's supported by healthy practices like getting enough sleep, getting regular exercise, eating healthy foods. Basically, you want to do things that decrease stress hormones. And children, you know, I mean, those are things that obviously are good for all of us, good for adults as well. Children will need more help doing those things regularly and with practicing self-care. So, again, you can see why it's so vital to have that trusted, caring adult involved in a child's life. Children can also learn how to practice skills that cultivate resilience. That's actually something that adults also can benefit from. So learning how to regulate your response to a stressful situation. It can include things like meditation or just learning how to practice self-regulation, where you train yourself to respond in a more positive way, sort of stopping, regulating your breathing, observing your own emotions and reactions to a situation.
Well, I want to thank you, Vanessa Sachs, for talking with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Vanessa Sachs is a research scientist at Child Trends. It's a nonpartisan research organization. She recently co-authored a new study that found that Ohio is one of five states with the highest share of children who face the most adverse childhood experiences. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sperm counts for men across Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand have fallen by half or more since 1973. Researchers blame environmental and lifestyle factors, but the bottom line is a potential male infertility crisis. Joining us now to talk about that and more issues of male health is urologist and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
How is sperm count measured?
Well, we ask a man to produce a specimen after 3 days of abstention. We put the specimen under a microscope. Sperm look like little tadpoles, so we count the tadpoles. We look and see if it's got one head and one tail. We call that morphology. And we like them swimming upstream in one direction. So we count them, we look at the shape and size, and we look at the motility. So it's really quite simple.
This study that I referred to, been looking at them since 1973, has it been a gradual decline, do we know, or was it more than that?
Yeah, my understanding was the study was done over a 38-year period between 1973 and 2011.
All right.
And men, Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, men's sperm count declined about 50 to 60% over that 38-year period, which is sort of shocking.
And is that a study that was done in other parts of the world and it's or just in those places and we don't really know what's happening in the rest of the world?
I'm not exactly sure who conducted that study, but we know that in the Middle East, for example, sperm counts have increased and fertility is improved in the Middle East. But the problem in the Middle East is there's a genetic sperm defect, whereas in the North Atlantic, North America, Australia, there doesn't seem to be the same genetic sperm defect. It just seems to be a decline in numbers.
Okay. Why is this becoming an issue now? Why is the word crisis bandied about?
Well, because, you know, one in four couples who are trying to have a baby are unable to do so because the male is infertile. I mean, it seems frightening. In the Middle East, they seem to have overcome this feeling of inferiority. Men afraid, to talk up about their own failure or their own infertility, and they've pushed IVF in vitro fertilization more so in the Middle East than in the United States. And in the United States, IVF is prohibitively expensive.
When do, like I said, they were looking from 1973 to 2011.
Right.
Do we know if it was a gradual decline or there was a tipping point?
My impression as a urologist, it was a gradual decline. Okay. I mean, it wasn't a sudden decrease of 50%. You woke up one morning and you had half the swimmers you
right.
had the day before, so I'm sure it was gradual. And a lot of scientists have obviously attributed to the surrounding environment, mm-hmm. Cell phones, radiation. So there seemed to be a host of underlying reasons. But the study that I think you're citing doesn't really give the reasons, just makes that mm-hmm. observation, which, of course, is scary to anyone trying to have a family.
What do you know as a urologist, you know, and an expert in men's health issues, reproductive health issues, what does negatively affect male fertility? What do we know does?
Well, we certainly know ibuprofen, which is used by lots of athletes. It's an NSAID, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. There's a myth about riding a bicycle. I think a recent study for a large number of people have proven that to be a myth, that you can ride a bicycle. You sometimes have some perineal numbness. That's numbness of the nerves in the seat of your pants. But it does not seem to affect fertility or sperm count.
So why does ibuprofen have that effect?
Well, ibuprofen actually affects a hormone called luteinizing hormone, which stimulates the testosterone to produce testosterone, which is beneficial in the production of sperm. And ibuprofen, for some reason, seems to block luteinizing hormone. Nobody knows why, but it's just the drug interaction. So things like Tylenol or Motrin all have that effect.
I'd have never heard about warnings on packages to that effect. Are there?
As far as I know, there are not.
Really?
Yes.
Once again, they could put a man on the moon, but why not?
Well, it's a good question. I think I will have to call up the drug company and tell them Dr. Danoff said to put a warning on it. So.
Multiple sclerosis is a degenerative team. I'm jumping ahead, but why the myth about cycling and bike seats and that kind of a thing? Why do you call it a myth? A lot of people believe that.
Well, I understand that. I think it's a lot of people think it because long-term bicycle riding will make you very numb in your perineum. And a lot of people believe that numbness is associated with lower sperm count. But a study was done of more than 2,500 cyclists, and it was found that their sperm count was no worse than somebody who was not a bicycler. So I think it's the numbness in the perineum,
uh-huh.
Which has created that myth. So cycling, I want to tell all the cyclists out there in Columbus,
there are a lot
cycling. Cycling does not cause ED.
The issue of men coming for help, that men aren't as open about their fertility issues as they should be, especially given these numbers we're talking about. How do you talk to men about fertility issues?
Well, men are hard to, you know, every man is a macho man. Every man wants to catch the final touchdown in the 3 seconds left in the Super Bowl. So it's very hard to get men to come in, for example, for PSA testing.
What's that?
Well, that's for prostate cancer.
Oh, okay.
It's a blood test. A woman, you know, wouldn't miss her mammogram or a pap smear in a year. A man, you have to push him. So we have to get out there and talk about it. I try to lecture around the country and tell men, you know, let's get out of the closet. You know, we're people. We're frail. But it's hard to get men to do it, and especially hard to get men to talk about infertility because many men equate infertility with manness. I can't father a child. I'm not a man.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, my guest is Dr. Dudley Danoff, Los Angeles-based urologist and author of the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Danoff, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page at WOSU, or the All Sides Facebook page as well. When they do come to you, is there anything you can do? And there is a low sperm count. Is there anything that you can do to reverse it or improve it?
Well, if we find that they're doing something which is adverse to their sperm count, stop it, obviously. There are some drugs that we can use to manipulate the sperm count and try to increase it temporarily. I mean, there's no panacea for a man with oligospermia, low sperm count. There's no panacea, no magic drug that's going to reverse that. Sometimes a man will have what's called a varicocele, that is a varicose vein in the scrotal sac, which heats up the testicle. Testicles like to reside in less than ambient temperature. That's why we have a scrotal sac. A man has a big varicocele. It heats up the testicle, so we can do a minor operation called a varicocelectomy, and that's very common and very, very helpful for both sperm count and sperm motility. But, you know, other than that, there isn't much.
Do you find that men tend to wait too long to come in to get help? I mean, because there's two sides of the equation. There's the male side and there's the female side. Men, though, as far as sperm go, their idea is that they never run out, whereas women do, their eggs get old and they go through menopause and they can't do it anymore.
Well, that's true. And it's true what you say, that sperm never run out. I mean, there are 90-year-old patients who have, you know, viable sperm, and at least theoretically, I mean, it only takes one. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sperm numbers go down, the sperm count goes down as a man ages, but pretty old men can have one, you know, one good swimmer, and that's it. it would be highly unlikely, but it's possible.
Are there any foods or diets that promote male sexual health?
Well, there are certainly a lot of people selling stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I think just low cholesterol, high protein, tofu, low carbs, an exercise program, stay fit, and get fit, and stay fit. Mm-hmm. All of those are good for sexual health. I mean, it takes some body strength, upper and lower, you know, to have sex. So good health equals good sex.
And as far as that environmental piece, are you concerned about that, about what the silent killers of sperm might be out there that we don't know about yet?
Well, obviously, as a health professional, I'm concerned, but I'm here scratching my head and say, what can I personally do about it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like a behemoth. I mean, it's like climate change. I had dinner with a highly intelligent man last night who denied climate change. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we each as individuals, I'm not sure what we can do about radiation in the environment. I mean, nobody listens to us when we're trying to get, you know, simple things done. So I'm very pessimistic, very.
Does cannabis or alcohol affect male sexual health?
Alcohol in excess obviously does. I mean, it's a very destructive chemical. Cannabis, I think the jury is still out on cannabis. It certainly affects your mentation. I have not seen any reports yet of the effect of cannabis on sperm count, so I think the jury is still out on that.
Hmm. There was another issue I wanted to talk about, the impact of testosterone and its effect or how it protects men from multiple sclerosis. What's the connection there?
Well, testosterone, so the situation is MS is more common in women than in men. It's more common in older men than younger men. And the effect or the key element here is testosterone. Testosterone triggers a guardian molecule that protects against MS. I mean, MS is a deterioration of the myelin sheath. That's a sheath around the nerves that supply muscles and go to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And MS attacks that myelin sheath, and testosterone seems to block that molecule from attacking the myelin sheath. So low testosterone in women and low testosterone in men, and that breeds an increase in MS. But that's the way the testosterone comes in.
And I mean, do men have any kind? I mean, so that's suggesting that men who get multiple sclerosis will have lower levels of testosterone?
That might suggest that, but the statistics are that it's relatively an uncommon disease in young, healthy males.
Mm-hmm.
It's a more common disease in older men, which equates to a decrease in circulating testosterone, and it is more common in women who obviously have even less testosterone.
Right. Right. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So can you, do you measure testosterone levels in men as part of your practice? Is that something you look at?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
It's part of our basic blood screening. So any man that comes into our office, he's tested for testosterone, he's tested for diabetes in a blood panel, he's tested for anemia, he's tested for liver function, the lipid panel, and all of those factors come into our treatment of a man, and any deficiencies should be corrected.
Is there ever going to be male birth control?
We're working on it. The problem is that there are things that block the synthesis of testosterone, but the side effects are very undesirable. So there's nothing available yet, but we are, our scientific people are in the laboratory as we speak and trying to do just that, but nothing clinically available at the moment.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Dudley Danoff. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I was just calling because I had an experience with a family member of mine who's a long-distance runner, and I know you spoke about bicyclists, but I was wondering if you could talk about endurance athletes and about how their sperm counts can be affected. With my relative, he would run long marathons and stuff, and him and his wife just couldn't conceive for the longest time, and he took a significant break, several months, from his long-distance running, and suddenly they could conceive without an issue, and they had their first child, and now they're well off, and he's back to running. So.
Well, I don't have any statistics on long-distance runners. There may be a factor. If he's taking exogenous testosterone, as many athletes will, so-called juicing, that will decrease his circulating serum, the number of sperm, reduces sperm count. But other than that, I don't know just the act of running. I don't know any concept that would fit that. But if he were taking exogenous testosterone, that would definitely decrease his sperm count.
Thanks, Chris, for that call. Going back to the testosterone-driven protective pathways and multiple sclerosis, are they looking at whether or not this could be part of a problem with other autoimmune diseases? Multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease.
If they are, I'm not aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, immune therapy is, very common in treating prostate cancers, and there's been enormous progress in that area. But I don't know of any specific disease in which they're looking, specifically at that. But certainly immune therapy in bladder cancer, in kidney cancer, which is my area of expertise,
mm-hmm.
immune therapy is common, and it's used, and it's very effective.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I want to thank Dr. Dudley Danoff. He's the author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health and a urologist in the Los Angeles area. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.